I'm going to begin this section dealing with biology, a spectacular role that language plays in the realm of biology. Prior to the mid-20th century, no one even suspected that the genetic specifications in living organisms might be linguistic in nature. No, I would say, at least in the literature, not an inkling that might be the case. But with the unveiling of the structure of DNA, that it was a double helix, that took place in 1953, Watson and Crick. Since that time, it's been discovered that nucleotide bases in DNA, that those are the links in the ladder-like structure, these serve as letters of a genetic language. This language specifies the structural details of living organisms, astonishingly to the level of the individual atom. Let me just repeat that the DNA instructions are able to specify the type and location of every atom in a living organism. It specifies it down to the level of the individual atom. So that's, if you're an engineer, that's the ultimate in nanotechnology. So that God has, in living organisms, has engineered them down to that level, and he's done it. He has a system by which that works, and it's the information, the description, the specifications are in the DNA and a few other places. There's information out beyond the DNA, it turns out, we're learning, but primarily in the DNA. So we're talking about incredible, incredible design in living systems. And so this is the double helix structure that was first figured out in 1953 by Watson and Crick in England at Cambridge. And when I talk about nucleotide bases, there are these links. There are a pair of them that link one side of that backbone with the other side. And these come in four different types. And they form the letters of the genetic alphabet. And we have about 3 billion such letters in the human DNA. And we have actually two copies, we have duplicate copies. You inherit one copy from your mother, one copy from your father. And the total length of the DNA is about 2 meters. If you unwound all the DNA, stretched it out, it will be about 2 meters in length. And that's all folded up very compactly within the cell nucleus. And most cells have that DNA in them. Okay. So a section of DNA, this shows a little more symbolic representation, a section of DNA showing the molecular structure of the four kinds of nucleotides. So,
we have these four nucleotides: adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, abbreviated A, C, G, and T. And so, here's the A, the C, the G, and the T. And so they are basically a carbon ring with some other atoms added. So these are those links in the chain. And the DNA language, this DNA language has an alphabet, those four letters, a vocabulary. Those letters are formed into three-letter words and a grammar. The DNA alphabet consists, as I said, of the four letters A, T, C, and G. The vocabulary, at least for describing proteins, consists of 64 three-letter words. So a very, very short vocabulary. And then simple grammatical rules exist for prescribing proteins. Here's the dictionary for translating these triplets of letters into specific amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. So here's the list of about 20 amino acids, and here are the words that code for a given amino acid. So let's say glycine is a common amino acid. It's coded with, it has four different words that all code for that amino acid, and so on down through the list. And the fact that multiple words code for the same amino acid means it provides the ability for the multiple messages to be overlaying over one another, so that a single nucleotide can be part of more than one message. And I may describe how that happens in a subsequent slide. To appreciate the astonishing power of genetic language to specify the structure of living organisms is helpful first to have a glimpse of what they are like, what these structures are like at the molecular level. Most cells and living organisms contain millions, literally millions, of nanoscale machines of astounding complexity, many of which are mobile and are contain moving parts. So for many of you, you're not aware that your cells have generally millions of moving parts. Some of these are rotary machines. Some of the most important machines rotate like motors within your cell. These nanoscale machines perform the myriads of functions required for the organism to live, utilize resources from its environment, and reproduce. This is an animation of a biped motor protein known as kinesin, and enables this protein to walk along a microtubule that runs as sort of the skeleton of the cell and carry a container, a vesicle. That's what this circle represents. So the protein is just the walking part, and it enables these vesicles to be moved from one part of the cell to another. This is another the artist's conception of that, showing a little more detail. These are the tubules. They're proteins, very well specified, and there are literally thousands of those crisscrossing the cell, providing structure for the cell, providing pathways for these little motor proteins to take things from one place to the other. And this is the transport vesicle. It can be containing chemicals that one part of the cell needs, but produced in some other part of the cell. And these actually have labels on them, like UPS labels. And these get shuffled around in a very organized way. So that's just a little beginning glimpse of the kind of complexity that exists in these cells. Okay. And this is these are liver cells from a monkey, and it's been stained to highlight the microtubules. And so all these red fibers are microtubules in a single cell. The blue is the cell nucleus that's stained. So there's a lot more structure in the cell. Those things are not stained, so they don't show up. These microtubules in the nucleus are stained, and they show up very well. So it gives you some, just the beginning glimpse of the kind of complexity that exists in the cell. Another example I want to show of these machines is a little machine called ATP synthase. It's a rotary machine that makes the chemical energy currency, if you will, little energy pellets, if you will, called ATP, that powers most cellular machines, such as the biped robots.
For each step that robot takes, it uses one molecule of ATP to take a step. So the cell needs lots of ATP to power all of the things going on. Now this ATP synthase machine, I'll show in the next slide, spins at on the order of 10,000 revolutions per minute. And it is driven electrically by a flow of protons and exists in every form of life on Earth, from bacteria to humans, plants. Every form of life on Earth has this ATP synthase motor in it. And this is what it looks like. And what it does is recycles ADP, which stands for adenosine diphosphate, and plus another phosphate unit back into adenosine triphosphate, ATP. Many of our cells contain hundreds of thousands of these tiny rotary machines in a single cell. The amount of ATP produced per day in our bodies approximately equals our body weight. So, say if you weigh, 80 kilograms, your body reconstitutes about 80 kilograms of ATP per day. You have about 50 grams of ATP, and that gets recycled about once a minute in your body. And so this is an important process. That weight, that mass of ATP getting processed, that's a huge process that takes place. And this is a picture of the ATP molecule itself. Each ball represents a different atom. The phosphorus atoms are orange, the oxygens are red, the carbons are black, the nitrogens are blue, and the hydrogen atoms are gray. So this is a very special molecule, the one that has the energy that most of the cellular processes use. And then where do these little machines live? They live in a what's called an organelle, a little capsule. And there can be as many as 1,000 of these little capsules in a single cell. And inside you see these gold dots. These are the ATP synthase motors where this conversion of ADP to ATP takes place. And so it's driven by hydrogen atoms on the outside of the membrane. The concentration of hydrogen atoms is higher, and so those flow through the machine and cause it to rotate. And so it basically is an electrical motor driven by protons instead of electrons. And in this case, this shows that where this conversion of ADP to ATP takes place. And each ball represents an individual atom. There are about 90,000 atoms in all in this machine. So it's... This again is showing you a little of the complexity that exists at the atomic level in living things. And this is another representation of ATP synthase, shows the rotating part. These little things coming in and out, the ADP is coming in. And the purple is the ADP is coming in, and the purple is the ATP that's reconstituted and coming out. So,
what is the purpose of the rotation?
You have mechanical energy being put in to put chemical energy back into the molecule. So there's this part is both is serves a catalytic purpose. The proteins catalyze that reaction, and the mechanical motion brings the phosphate very close to the A D
DP causes that bond to be reestablished and for the higher energy state to come about. So that the rotation is the transforms mechanical energy into chemical energy. And the food that's digested produces this this gradient in the hydrogen atoms.
So don't stop eating.
Yeah. So, and it's understood that one reason we slow down as we age, is that this machinery, when these machines are rebuilt, there are some mistakes that are made. The specifications are not what they originally were, and these machines are not as efficient. And so this process of making our energy for ourselves suffers as a result. So so my wife sells nutritional products, and one product she sells is a form of resveratrol. Resveratrol is understood to help keep this machinery running. And experiments in laboratory animals shows that animals with resveratrol live about 25% longer. So anyway, whether that's going to work for me, we'll have to see. But anyway, when you start to understand all of this machinery, and you know, it should encourage you to eat a little more carefully. Watch what you eat a little more carefully. Okay. So all these machines, I've just shown a few of them, are the machines themselves are manufactured within the cell. So we've got other machines that manufacture these all these machines. And so the detailed specifications for forming each protein are encoded in the organism's DNA. And so we see a process here of translating the DNA into proteins. I'm going to show you the machine that does that. So in many cases, you have multiple proteins come together to build the bigger machine. That's the case with the ATP synthase. I think there are about 20 proteins, different proteins, you need to build an ATP synthase machine. So the proteins that form the cellular machines are themselves manufactured, as I said, by special cellular machines known as the ribosomes. And so this is the ribosome. There's a tape with the information called messenger RNA. The messenger RNA is basically a copy of what's in the DNA. And that comes out of that copying process takes place within the nucleus. This tape, if you will, this strip of messenger RNA gets outside the cell, goes into a ribosome, and there are other proteins that are called, this is RNA, called transfer RNA, that bring a specific amino acid along. And so here's the amino acid. This is the transfer RNA that's bound to an amino acid, has the complementary letters on it that will match up with this tape. And so this is the way that the specific sequence of amino acids is specified to put together a new protein. So what comes out then of the ribosome is this new protein as new amino acids are added one by one. So, you know, that process is going on like crazy all the time in your cells to rebuild everything. So, again, the ribosome is a complex molecular machine found within all living cells that joins that join amino acids together in the order specified by a strand of messenger RNA to fashion a protein. And these ribosomes, using with the same machinery, are able to manufacture about 100
6,000 different proteins. So it's a very, you know, in some of our factories we have machines dedicated to manufacturing, say, a bearing or part of a bearing or part of an automobile, some automobile part, a numerically controlled machine that actually manufactures that. This machine is able to manufacture all of the proteins that the cell needs. So it's a pretty important component, this ribosome. Okay, so what about hemoglobin? How's it manufactured? Well, it involves four different proteins, two alpha chain hemoglobin proteins and two beta chain. And then they're produced by the ribosome, they come together and form this kind of complex structure that contains four what are called heme groups, each one with an iron atom in it. So this is the way hemoglobin is able to carry oxygen around our body. It's bound by the iron atom, and it's a very special structure. And so what begins as four linear chains of amino acids folds into the 3D hemoglobin structure. The final structure depends critically on the 3D distribution of charge on the surface of the amino acid links forming the chains. So not just any amino acid sequence will do. It's very special, very specific, that's going to serve as a hemoglobin molecule. So at this point, we've only begun to discover all this astonishing bioinformational, biochemical, and biomechanical technology, how all this works in a seamless manner. Such complexity makes human technology underlying our cell phones appear as mere child's play by comparison. So this is a level of technology so far beyond anything human beings have ever even dreamed of doing. It just there's no comparison. So this linguistic coding that we see in the natural realm, from whence did it arise? In the realm of human experience, we can identify a source of linguistic expression. That source is the human mind. If we are open to the possibility, this observation can lead us by analogy to infer that a plausible explanation for the linguistic content we find in the natural realm is an entity with mental faculties qualitatively similar to our own, but vastly superior, including those faculties of thinking, reason, making choices, faculties which we ourselves employ when we create linguistic content. If ever there was objective and unquestionable evidence for intelligent intellectual capacities far, far exceeding our own, would not the linguistic messages in our own DNA surely qualify? I would say an entity possessing such astonishing mental powers certainly qualifies as God in the way most people understand that term. And I would ask, what other rational alternative can there possibly be? There is none. There is no other possibility. So, to me, if ever there was clear objective evidence for God's reality, we find that in the genetic specifications of living organisms. There's no other possibility than a mind, as we would understand God having, to be responsible. So, a God who speaks. Many today acknowledge evidence for a designer behind the realm of nature, but are reluctant to go further. Yet the linguistic attributes of such a designer who created all the living organisms around us, as well as the laws of nature, ought to draw a person's attention to the God of the Bible. And according to the Bible, he's a God who speaks. He's a God of language. The Bible, from its first page to its last, discloses a God who speaks. and especially in the Bible's opening verses when God speaks, things happen. 10 times in the Bible's first chapter, we find the phrase, "And God said." In 5 of these 10 instances, what God is recorded as speaking is followed immediately by the phrase, "And it was so." And God said, "And it was so." Taken at face value, the biblical text indicates that it was God's spoken declarations which brought about these aspects of his creation into existence in a miraculous, instantaneous manner. Other biblical passages affirm this inference. Psalm 33:6, for example, declares, "By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth." And verse 8 adds, "For he spoke, and it was done. He commanded, it stood fast." So that these passages very clearly are describing that the God of the Bible brought creation into existence miraculously, supernaturally, near instantaneously by his spoken word. And I would say, as far as living things are concerned, with the complexity that we find in them, there's no other conceivable way such structures could come into existence except by near instantaneous, miraculous creation, supernatural creation. And for me, as a creationist, I camp on that. I mean, that is a foundational point in my whole worldview. Seems to be absolutely required, logically required. Living things require near instantaneous and supernatural creation. And these are the most complex entities we know of in all of creation. So if living things require that kind of origin, that kind of explanation for how they came to be, then for me it's not a stretch that he, in a similar way, created the earth, the solar system, including the sun, and even the cosmos itself. That it had to involve supernatural activity. So I stand firm on that, even though I'm involved in applying scientific methods to try to understand the flood, and more recently I've been involved in some cosmological modeling, trying to understand how God might have formed the cosmos. I'm quick to acknowledge that almost certainly the supernatural had to be involved. So I say, you know, as a trained scientist, that's my position, and that's the logic of it. That's the reasoning behind it. Why I do not hesitate to understand the creation to have involved the supernatural intervention by God. So there are many Christians that back away. In fact, I find it somewhat puzzling that so many Christians react to what I present when I talk about God's supernatural intervention. Most Christians don't want that. You know, they resist the idea that God acts supernaturally. But anyway, what I see in biology causes me to be completely convinced that was the way the original creation came about, and that he's not adverse to have done it in since then. I believe 2 Peter chapter 3 says that he intervened supernaturally during the flood. So I don't think I mentioned that last night. Finally, thus the Bible indicates that God created the physical universe and life itself through his spoken word. Not only this, according to Scripture, the Messiah himself, our Lord Jesus, is referred to as the Word, who became flesh and dwelt among us. The Bible, throughout its pages, reveals a God who communicates, who has revealed his goodness and favor, and who desires everyone to be saved through faith in his Son, the Lord Jesus. So I believe with this kind of understanding of what we've talked about today, that should encourage us to be bold and compassionate and be ready to communicate the glorious gospel message. So thank you very much.